The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 114, a paper entitled, Did Joseph Smith Use the Bible as a Rosetta Stone to Translate the Golden Plates? The presenter is Terry Turman, with a response by Mike Ash.
Good morning. Our chair, David Anderson, is he here? Then let's get started. This is session 114. Did Joseph Smith use the Bible as a Rosetta Stone to translate the Golden Plates? I should tell you that admission to this session is by this or ticket. And if you don't have either, you can buy your ticket out at the front desk. Our speaker tells me that he has some copies of his presentation or notes for it here if you want to pick them up.
You're under the gate.
I don't have biographical information, so I'm going to let the speaker and the respondent introduce themselves. Please turn off all cell phones, pagers, and other noisemakers. And I think that's all that it takes.
On the board of directors, so not the director.
On the board of directors, okay. Our speaker is Terry Turman. He's a Mormonism from the Episcopal faith. He's an instructor in physics, math, and astronomy at Los Angeles State and Cypress College. And he's a board of director, he's on the board of directors of Peninsula Astro Society. Our respondent is Mike Ash, master, the mortress, a member and contributor of FAIR, and has also been published in Dialogue and the Farms Review.
Will that do it?
Okay. Let's go.
Okay. Okay. I have a physics, math background, degrees from Stanford and Caltech, and coming from that background, I don't know what a seer stone is, or an ermine or a thurman. It was never explained at Stanford or Caltech, so that colors my approach to the translation issue in the Golden Plates. Been looking for a way that I would understand in which the plates might have been translated. Mine coming from a position that the plates are real, that there are real things written on the plates, that they really do correspond to what got translated in the Book of Mormon. Now, one famous point of translation that occurred about the same time as Joseph Smith lived was the Rosetta Stone. How many people have heard of the Rosetta Stone? Just about everybody has heard. Okay, you know, it was found by Napoleon's troops in Egypt about 1801 AD, I believe. It was about 4 years before Joseph Smith was born. And it's a stone, it goes back to about 196 BC at the time of the Ptolemaic kings. These were Greek kings running Egypt who were left over essentially from a line established by Alexander the Great during his conquests. And there's copies of my talk on the projector, anybody wants them. Now, at the time, in 1800, we had all these Egyptian hieroglyphics on walls and tombs and on obelisks and everything in Egypt, and nobody knew how to translate them. The last hieroglyphics had been carved about 300 AD, and the knowledge of that language and that script was lost. There was also some ancient script version of the ancient Egyptians put up, which was probably the same language as the hieroglyphics, but in a script that's a little more like the ancient Greek and and Hebrew scripts, but still not understandable. Well, after they found this Rosetta Stone, it was in three things. The top was in hieroglyphics, and then there was the demotic script of Egyptian, and then there was Greek at the bottom. And, of course, Greek was a known language. Greek is the language of the New Testament and the language of classical era of Greece. And so people were able to go to the second page, gives you a part of what was in Greek. That's only about a quarter of the total amount of things that are in Greek. But they could go on the assumption that this was a proclamation of the king being written in three different languages, or at least alphabets, and from that work out, from the starting with the Greek, how to translate hieroglyphics. And there's really just from this one big stone, you know, it's weighed a ton or so, it's fairly big, but that was the clue. Now, they also had some help in that they correctly guessed there were some similarities to the ancient Egyptian language and the liturgical language of the Coptic Christian Church, that was the Christian Church in Egypt that had one time been the established church, and they had become a minority church after the Arabs moved in and Muslim became the dominant religion. But the clergy were still using an ancient language, just as Roman Catholic priests until quite recently used Latin in their liturgy. Okay, so this shows you how you can learn how to translate a language if you've got some material that's identical in both the unknown language and a known language. Now, if you go to the case of Joseph Smith and look at the golden plates, one of the things that's striking about the golden plates is there are a large number of chapters in there that are identical to chapters in the Bible. In particular, this is on page 3 of the handout here. It shows you there's no less than 21 chapters in all that are word for word identical, with the exception maybe of one introductory word. Now, two of those are from the book of Malachi, which is the last two chapters in the book of Malachi, the last two chapters in the Old Testament, and they are quoted verbatim in 3rd Nephi, and they are quoted by the resurrected Christ appearing in the New World. The other chapters come earlier, and they are 19 chapters of Isaiah appear in their entirety, essentially, in the Book of Mormon. Now, of those 19, you have it's word for word the same as the King James Bible. Now, if you go to the King James Bible, you will find quite a few words in italics. These words are ones that aren't literally in the original Hebrew, but are supplied to make the read a little more grammatically. And this is mentioned on page 4. So about 4% of the words in the King James Version of the Old Testament are in italics, meaning not in original Hebrew, but have been added to the English translation for reasons of grammar or context. In the King James New Testament, about 2% of the English words are in italics and not in the original Greek. About half of these italicized words appear in the Book of Mormon in the passages that I call identical. The Book of Mormon often adds the word "and" to the beginning of sentences in these identical passages. This may be due to the fact that Joseph Smith dictated the entire book to scribes who didn't know whether "and" was directed at them or part of the text. The Mormon Church did light editing of Joseph Smith's dictated text to improve spelling, grammar, and punctuation. This removed many, but not all, of the unnecessary "ands." So that's there. But aside from that, there is really remarkable agreement. And it represents about 10%, close to 10% of the total Book of Mormon is taken, just literally. And there's also some partial chapters that are taken, particularly in the in 3 Nephi, there's quotes of, partial quotes taken from Matthew. In fact, the Sermon on the Mount appears in the Book of Mormon, and it follows Matthew's version rather than Luke's version. So that is an argument that Matthew's version of the Sermon on the Mount is a little more authentic. Actually, Luke had a sermon on a plane, for what that is worth. Just ignore this thing about in color down at the corner. That had to do with a private joke with the teacher of the writer's workshop that I was in this spring. And he has in his bathroom of his house, not one, but two paintings of dogs playing poker hanging on the wall on black velvet in his bathroom. So that was a private joke. Okay, so if now, but how does, first place you would ask, how does Joseph Smith know what corresponds to what? I mean, the golden plates are, you know, correspond to, you know, 239 chapters of the appear in the golden plates, plus there was 116 pages lost from the original. The first part of the translation, which are a few more chapters. And so somehow Joseph Smith would have to know exactly which parts of the golden plates correspond to which chapters of Isaiah or whatever in the Bible. Also, he would have needed quite a bit of time to have worked on it. Well, I came up with the idea, in the first place, that you can make a quick copy of something. You can put a thin piece of paper on top of it, something that's been etched in metal or stone, engraved in stone, and do a rubbing. You take a piece of charcoal and you rub the thin paper against the thing you want to copy, and it comes out with a negative. What's engraved shows as white, the rest is dark. And that's a technique commonly used by archaeologists when they encounter things, and it's used by people who make, today, make gravestone rubbings and rubbings of other things. So this is something that Joseph Smith could have done even fairly quickly for these particular chapters if he knows where they are in the golden plates. And there's two explanations of how he might have known. One is he might have been told by the angel Moroni what it was that he should copy. Or it might have been marked on the margins of the plates in some fashion. Now let me go into that. Let me backtrack for a moment into the whole business of the hill and where the original setting for the golden plates might have been geographically. There's mention of a narrow neck of land, and of course the plates turn up in the hill Cumorah, which is upstate New York. And the first thing they thought of was maybe that narrow neck of land was the narrow neck of land between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. And the land northward would have been Canada, and the land southward would have been New York. That didn't work out too well for one thing, a couple of reasons. One is there's no mention of snow in the Book of Mormon. Pioneers wrote a lot about snow and cold weather in their journals, and they're suffering from this. Nothing about that in the Book of Mormon. Another idea was that, well, this Book of Mormon seemed to imply that the continents were empty when Nephites arrived from Middle East, from the area around Jerusalem, about 600 BC. So maybe the land northward was North America, and the land southward was South America, and the narrow neck of land was the Isthmus of Panama, or the Panama Canal. Well, then they looked at that closely, and it turned out to be problems with how far you could travel in a given amount of time, and it also the kind of impassable swamps just beyond the Panamanian border. They've never been able to put the Panamanian highway all the way through because of this impassable swampy area. And so it didn't look promising that you could actually interpret the geography that way. So the next idea, which seems to be the most popular one these days, at least the late Hugh Nibley was advocate of it, is that the Mesoamerica formula, that in the narrow part of Mexico between Mexico City and the Yucatan Peninsula, things narrow down a bit, and it's like 114 miles from Pacific to Atlantic, and that was the narrow neck of land. And in the rainy season, the lowlands get impossibly flooded with water. You can't travel, and so the narrow neck of land becomes really a narrow, hilly strip of land near the Pacific coast. Now, this narrow neck of land runs east-west, not north-south, but we know that directions can kind of get tilted. Overall, of course, North America and South America are north-south, even though a section of that runs east-west. In fact, the Panamanian Isthmus runs roughly east-west. I come from Mountain View and near San Jose on the San Francisco Peninsula. And here, the peninsula near San Francisco and through San Mateo County next to it runs north-south, and then the peninsula begins to curve, and it's running east-west by the time you're down at San Jose. And all the highways, I-1 and El Camino, that are running north-south near San Francisco are running east-west by the time we get down to San Jose. But people still talk about north on those freeways and streets as if it were the thing that will curve up and go north, but it's going west now, but it will curve and go north. And so the entrance to the freeway, say, you're northbound 280, northbound 101, when you're really going west, and generally southbound when you're really going east. So it's understandable how that could have been turned around. Now, this implies, though, that you wonder, well, how did the Golden Plates get to New York State if the area of the described of the history of the Book of Mormon is down Mesoamerica? It includes Mexico City down, and also Guatemala, much of Honduras, some of the neighboring Central American states. It's also the same area that has all the buildings, the cities that were built before Columbus, and the area that had a form of writing before Columbus. Okay, unlike the Incas, which did not have writing. Okay, so the two things. One is that maybe Mormon traveled a great distance, thousands of miles from the battle scene where the Nephites are defeated by the Lamanites, and then buried the plates. Or other ideas, he buried the plates locally, and there's a hill Cumorah down in Mesoamerica somewhere. Some people think they have, know where it might be on the map. And then someone else later dug up those plates and moved them northward, where they ended up in New York. Okay, so now, if you have that's the two Cumorah theory. So you have some people who, I call them guardians of the golden plates, who dig them up in the first hill Cumorah in Mesoamerica, and they guard them, and they end up, maybe generations later, burying them in upstate New York. Now, is this unwild? Well, remember, when Joseph Smith is presented with the plates, two-thirds of the plates are sealed. He never had access to more than one-third of the golden plates. For some reason, he wasn't permitted with or trusted with looking at the two-thirds sealed part. So you can wonder what's in the two-thirds sealed part, since the one-third part is essentially a history, a kind of biblical-type history in which intervention of God and whether people are obeying God's rules or whatnot counts crucially in how events unfold. Reasonable supposition would be the sealed two-thirds are similar. The sealed two-thirds may, in fact, cover history from the time when the plates end, where the Book of chapters on Mormon, written by Mormon and Moroni, close out the Book of Mormon about 421 A.D. on up to maybe through the Spanish conquest. Who knows? I mean, over 1,000 years later with the show up, and then it was still, which is nearly 500 A.D., and then there's another 300-plus years till Joseph Smith looks at things. So you got a period of at least 1,000 years, maybe 1,300 years, more history perhaps found in those sealed parts of the golden plates, which implies that you've got a group of people who are guiding them and writing them and adding to them and writing what is now the Joseph Smith found the sealed part of the golden plates. Okay, so now you've got, in addition to the angel Moroni, there are maybe some people around, physical human beings, who know something about the golden plates, have some responsibility for them, maybe even up in upstate New York. Joseph Smith writes about the three Nephites in his translation of the golden plates. And these were people from the set apart by Jesus when the resurrected Christ appeared in the new world. He set three people apart, and they sort of would keep on going indefinitely. They wouldn't die. They were translated in some form that they would keep on. And then Joseph Smith, during his travels, at one point mentions to his companions that, I see one of the three Nephites over there. So there may even have been one or two or three Nephites may at some point given Joseph Smith assistance in translation. This is not out of the question. And Joseph Smith would never really confide exactly how he translated. He left that as something of a mystery. Now, my idea is, and so the markings on the edge of the golden plates that identify what chapters of Isaiah or even Malachi are on certain parts of the golden plates, they might have been marked in the margins by these people who were guardians of the golden plates, the same people who were writing the sealed parts. They might have gone into the Spanish period. Something might have got written on the margin in Spanish or in Latin. I've looked at the words Isaiah and Malachi in Spanish and Latin, and they're similar enough to the words, you could recognize them. And they say, if you always resort to the end, the angel Moroni could have told him a few things. The angel Moroni makes a few quotes from the Bible to Joseph Smith. So I'm willing to grant Joseph Smith some help from an angel and some inspiration from God, but I am reluctant to have him do the entire responsibility of translating everything from scratch. Now, remember, Joseph Smith first encounters the golden plates in September of 1823, and then each year, for the next 4 years, he gets to visit the golden plates. And so, finally, in September 1927, he physically gets hold of the golden plates, and he begins translation the following year in early part of 1828. He comes up with 116 pages, which he lends to Oliver Cowdery, who to show to someone.
Hmm?
Mark Harris, right? Mark Harris, excuse me. And Mark Harris loses them somehow, and which is a big setback. And Joseph Smith decides against the idea of retranslating. He's afraid that someone will compare what Mark Harris had with what he would do. It wouldn't be the same, or maybe what people got hold of Mark Harris's pages, they would change things and to try to embarrass Joseph Smith. And for whatever reason, he doesn't retranslate those 116 pages. But the next, a year goes by, and he starts translating again. He's doing it first slowly, and then he gets into a period of around May, June, where he's translating 10 pages a day. When all his translations, Joseph Smith is not writing anything down. He is behind a curtain and looking at something and verbally dictating to a scribe who ends up, several different scribes are involved, but the one who ends up doing most of the translation is Oliver Cowdery, I believe. At the time he's translating 10 pages a day. Now that is a remarkable number, because people today, when they translate the Book of Mormon into various foreign languages, and people who are familiar with both English and the other language, and they have dictionaries and everything, they're still only translating about one page a day. And Joseph Smith was translating 10 pages a day. Now, dictating 10 pages a day. Now, my idea is that Joseph Smith, he got some, probably rubbings, he got some copies of the material you could compare with a Rosetta Stone style, and worked out the basic dictionary and grammar of Reformed Egyptian, and he had about 5 years to work this out before he gets to where he's really dictating. Four and a half years before he starts any dictation, and 5.5 years before he starts fluently dictating. He's got time enough to write what's known as an interliner. I don't know biblical Hebrew or Greek, but I have at home interliners where the Bible is laid out in its original language, and between the lines is English words that word for word translate what is in the original script. And with this, this is the kind of thing that Joseph Smith could have developed over time, and he wouldn't have had every possible word, because some words that would be in the Golden Plates would not have appeared in these chapters of Isaiah and Malachi. But he would have had the basics of the language, and he would have needed some inspiration to make a translation. I grant that. There's certainly some inspiration, I would say some divine inspiration involved, but Joseph Smith doesn't have to do anything from scratch. Kind of analogy today would be missionaries at the missionary training center, where they've only got a few weeks to learn a foreign language, and then they go out in the field, and now, of course, they're with a senior missionary who's more fluent in the language, but they pick up a foreign language amazingly fast. Our public schools, even our universities, can't teach a language as fast as the missionaries pick it up. They are using some, I believe, divine inspiration to help them become familiar with the language. And so that's kind of the situation I think of for Joseph Smith. So this is my idea. I would say as to other ideas of what might be in the sealed parts, quite likely it was not in Reformed Egyptian. It may have been in native languages, in the languages of the Mayans, in the script that they wrote. Some of it may well have been in Spanish if it went into the Spanish period, or even in Latin if it was Christian priest of the Spanish period who was involved in guarding the golden plates. I think they need guardians, because the Spanish were notorious for melting down and shipping it back to Spain, melting down all kinds of priceless artifacts of the Mayas and the Aztecs and the Incas and shipped them back. So the golden plates needed guardianship. You would not have wanted them to get in the hands of Spanish authorities or Catholic Church authorities. And there may also have been, in that sealed part, more testimonies of the risen Jesus Christ appearing in America and preaching to various peoples. Question of what ever happened to him. Joseph Smith says that in 1838 he gave them back to Moroni. At that point he didn't specify messenger Moroni, and maybe there was a physical person named Moroni who received the golden plates back rather than the angel. I don't know if angels do heavy lifting or not. Maybe, maybe not. Some people think angels rolled away the stone from the tomb of Jesus so that the tomb was open when Mary Magdala came on the third day with others to look for Jesus. So maybe angels can do heavy lifting. I'm not sure. Anyway, there's no suggestion that the golden plates were destroyed or lost. Or anything bad happened to them, they were just given back to whoever had responsibility for them in the first place. And it implies that the golden plates are still around. I don't think they're sitting in a vault in the temple basement of any other place of the LDS church hierarchy. I think we would have heard about them if that was true. So I think they're someplace in the safekeeping of the guardians of the golden plates. And now that we are learning just in the last few years how to translate the writings of the Mayans, of the peoples of Mesoamerica, maybe the time is coming when the plates will resurface and it'll be time to look at the sealed parts of the golden plates and give a correct translation of them and compare in the unsealed parts that Joseph Smith had, compare how accurate his translation was. I would warn people that, of course, we have more than one translation of the Bible. And if this happens in the future of the Golden Plate service, you will get other people's translations of the Golden Plates that aren't exactly like Joseph Smith did, and I wouldn't worry about it. There are translations that are formal equivalences. King James Bible is a pretty formal equivalent to the Hebrew Greek scripts that they had. There's more dynamic translations, which they tend to paraphrase things, and then there are things that are really loose kinds of translations. Just to give the general idea, an example of those would be, you go to the web and you look up comics, and some comics are there in both Spanish and English, and the translations from English to Spanish are pretty loose in those comics. They're just trying to get, you know, across a general idea or a joke or something. And so there's an example of a pretty loose translation. I wouldn't be disturbed at all if turns out Joseph Smith made a fairly loose translation. He had a target audience that he wanted to communicate with, and he would have been justified in writing what was communicated with them, and he did so effectively as you look at the growth of the church. So that's about it for what I want to say and my ideas of how the Book of Mormon got translated from the golden plates. It did not involve magic. My idea, it did not involve, well, it's involved in Urim and Thummim. They were maybe magnifying glasses. You polished gems that were polished so that they magnified, because the golden plates, being metal, would have been thicker than paper, and therefore the writing must have been small for them to get all that material onto metal plates. And so maybe Joseph Smith needs a magnifying addition. Maybe also those stones got him in the frame of mind that he got into the feel of a language. If you're speaking a foreign language, you need to get into the feel of the language and so forth, and they may have helped him with that. But I look at a pretty academic view. Because Joseph Smith was an intelligent person. He didn't have a lot of formal schooling, but then he didn't need a lot of formal schooling if he could apply intelligence over a period of 5 years, plus some inspiration from above, and maybe even some help from the three Nephites. I'm not sure about that. Okay, so that's my model for how the golden plates were translated. And I'll now turn things over to my responder, Mike.
Bible verses repeated in the Book of Mormon. What do we make of them? There's an obvious connection between the King James Bible and the Book of Mormon, and several theories abound. Terry has added another to the list of possibilities. At a church conference in 1831, Hiram Smith invited the prophet to tell the congregation how the Book of Mormon was translated. Joseph Smith replied that it was not intended to tell the world all the particulars of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, and it was not expedient for him to relate these things. This opened the door to speculation. There are, however, numerous problems that I have with Terry's translation theory. The first has to do with Oliver's attempt at translating. If Joseph had already developed a key to Reformed Egyptian, it seems logical that Joseph would have allowed Oliver to use that key in his attempt at translating the Nephite record. Had this been the case, it would have been little more than an academic exercise to translate, yet the Lord told Oliver that he had not understood. Oliver had supposed that the Lord would give him the translation just by asking. If Joseph had a Rosetta Stone to Reformed Egyptian, why would Oliver simply ask for a translation? Why wouldn't he have known that he would have needed to study the key in order to translate? We also have the problem of Terry's academic approach to the translation process because of his discomfort with a translation that was received via a seer stone, or as he says, magic, or through the Urim and Thummim. As many LDS scholars have suggested, the seer stone was possibly nothing more than a perceived focal point for connection or meditation. Joseph believed that, by the power of God, he could see marvelous things in special stones, and it seems probable that the Lord used cultural beliefs as a tool for Joseph to open his mind to revelation. It seems unlikely, if not impossible, that Joseph would actually have been able to read with his natural eyes anything in the close proximity of his face and hat directly over a seer stone, even if that stone had the power to shine and display words. It seems more likely that his spiritual eyes, saw a window in heaven and somehow displayed the words of the plates or the words of his mind that formed ideas that were revealed to him. The Book of Mormon, if Terry's uncomfortable with using a seer stone or some type of magic for interpretation, well, we find the same thing, of course, in the Book of Mormon. I would suspect he'd have discomfort with that, where we read about a prophet who interprets ancient writings by way of interpreters. In Mosiah and Alma, we read that the interpreters are used by a seer to read ancient scripture and to understand the mysteries they contain. There is no mention of a Rosetta Stone type of key needed for a correct translation. That Joseph's seer stone was merely a tool to invoke revelation seems supported by the fact that earlier revelations, as recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants, were revealed by the Urim and Thummim, very possibly the seer stone, whereas later revelations were not. Eventually, Joseph quit using the seer stone and apparently gave it to Oliver, saying he no longer needed this stone for revelation. According to one source, Orson Pratt mentioned that as Joseph used the Urim and Thummim in the translation of the Book of Mormon, he, Pratt, wondered why Joseph did not use it in the translation of the New Testament. Joseph explained to him that the experience he had acquired while translating the Book of Mormon by the use of the Urim and Thummim had rendered him so well acquainted with the spirit of revelation prophecy that in the translating of the New Testament he did not need the aid that was necessary in the first instance. Apparently, Joseph had come to recognize that it was by revelation and not a stone itself that he was receiving the will of the Lord. This presents a problem for Terry's model. If Joseph technically could have received revelation as to the words on the golden plates without a seer stone, the theory of plate rubbing seemed not only unnecessary, but also contrary to the way ancient scripture was translated in the Book of Mormon times, and contrary to Joseph's later revelations. According to Polly P. Pratt, the Book of Abraham, at least initially, was translated by the means of the Urim and Thummim. A reformed Egyptian Rosetta Stone would be useless in such a translation. Terry's model would necessarily have formulated another real Rosetta Stone for Joseph to translate ancient Egyptian. And of course, we won't go into the discussions about what we find on the Joseph Smith papyri and how they actually relate to translation. But nevertheless, in the model, it seems that he would have to have a different Rosetta Stone to translate that, since his quote-unquote Rosetta Stone applied strictly to reformed Egyptian. Scholars of Mormonology, both believers and critics, generally agree on certain fundamental issues, but disagree, at least the historical issues, but disagree on the interpretation of many of these issues. Believers, for example, generally accept the traditional history that an angel named Moroni visited Joseph and introduced him to the record of an ancient civilization. Critics believe that Joseph either concocted the story of Moroni, imagined that he had been visited by Moroni, or that Joseph initially believed that a treasure guardian, whom he later named Moroni, contacted him in regards to a buried treasure. Both believers and critics, however, generally agree that in early LDS tradition, Joseph claimed that he had been visited by a supernatural being who gave him gold plates. Believers believe that the power of God, that it was by the power of God that the religious history of the Nephites, as contained in the Book of Mormon plates, was revealed to Joseph, who dictated the history to a scribe. Critics usually believe that Joseph either fabricated or stole the Book of Mormon story, or that he believed he was receiving revelation about an ancient race, whereas he was actually creating the story from elements floating in his subconscious or conscious memory. Both believers and critics, however, generally agree that Joseph, using a seer stone in a hat, claimed to see what was contained on the plates and actually dictated to a scribe. In these and other instances, believers and critics agree that there were scribes, a seer stone, and that Joseph claimed to have interacted with the spirit of a deceased being. Terry's approach is not simply novel because his interpretations are unique, but they are novel because they add elements that are not only not accepted by believers or critics, but because they appear to be contrived to fit his theory and do not exist independently of his speculations. In science of scholarship, there is a Latin term known as ad hoc, which basically designates a solution that has been contrived or tailored for a specific purpose, such as a tailor-made suit. An ad hoc hypothesis is defined as a stipulation, or one might say a modified position, that is adopted purely for the purpose of saving a theory from difficulty or refutation without any independent motivation or rationale. For example, an original claim might be that a bird is any creature that can fly. If this claim is rebutted with the example of mosquitoes, an ad hoc response might be, a bird is any creature that can fly and is not a mosquito. The modification serves no other purpose other than salvaging the original claim. A better modification might be, a bird is any creature that can fly which has a backbone. Some critics have claimed that certain LDS apologetic arguments constitute ad hoc hypotheses. While it is certainly possible that some apologetic arguments may be so construed, and it is equally possible that some critical arguments may qualify as ad hoc hypotheses as well, in my opinion, most scholarly arguments for and against the Book of Mormon more closely resemble conflicting paradigms. Since no paradigm is free of all anomalies, progressive modifications are often required to update a paradigm as new information is gleaned. Daniel Little, non-LDS professor of philosophy at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, claims that modifications can be progressive rather than ad hoc if the modifications can be corroborated from information outside the original theory. That is, an ad hoc theory is dependent for its existence on the original theory. Generally, and stated very simply, an ad hoc hypothesis will simply save a current concept against conflicting evidence, whereas a progressive modification will account for other phenomena and will increase one's knowledge about the observable and what is already known. As another scholar explains, an ad hoc hypothesis considers the theory of ectoplasm. In this theory, once popular with spiritualists, the mediums exude a strange substance, ectoplasm, which disembodied spirits can use to form temporary bodies. This was meant to explain how spirits could move or be photographed. One problem with this theory is that ectoplasm never appears anywhere but in dark seance rooms, where no one can get a good look at it or subject to scientific study. This is explained as due to ectoplasm being photosensitive. That is, it is sensitive to light and is destroyed by exposure to bright light. Now, this is all very interesting, you might say, but where's the ad hoc hypothesis? It's the hypothesis that ectoplasm is photosensitive, since it serves no other purpose than to explain why mediums work in dark rooms. An alternative explanation is they do so because it's easier to get away with things in the darkness. In Terry's theory, Joseph made rubbings of plates which he studied for 4 years, from his original encounter with Moroni until his final acquisition of plates. In Terry's theory, Joseph used the rubbings to create a Rosetta Stone whereby he had a key to translate the rest of the Book of Mormon. And of course, his theory includes what I would almost think of as Book of Mormon Illuminati, as the guardians of the plates protecting these, okay? There's absolutely no evidence for these rubbings or the Illuminati outside of Terry's theory. In my estimation, they are an ad hoc hypothesis to account for King James quotations found in the Book of Mormon. His theory is fascinating approach to the broad problem. His beliefs that the Book of Mormon text was translated once is the key that cracked by the way of King James passages would be exciting if we're not so laden with problems. In the end, I'm not persuaded as to the validity of the theory when it cannot be reconciled and occasionally contradicts with what we do know and can only exist in the realm of speculation. My thanks to Terry, however, for offering an unconventional approach to the as yet, in my opinion, unresolved issue as to why the King James verses are reproduced in the Book of Mormon. Thank you.
I want to thank Mike Ask for giving a very well thought out commentary on my comments, and he raises legitimate points in there. I just mentioned one thing. At the bottom of the abstract that's printed in your program, it says the Book of Mormon authenticity doesn't require historicity. I should maybe explain what that means. If you take the example of the Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered a few decades ago in caves near the Dead Sea, they are genuinely authentic in the sense that there's no doubt that they're old. They're on very brittle pieces of parchment, a little bit on metal, mostly on parchment, that's obviously old. You can carbon date it, it comes out old. You can look at the calligraphy of the writing, and it matches that period around 200 BC to around up to Jesus' time. And so everything matches that those Dead Sea Scrolls are genuinely old. Now, and a lot of the material in there is in the Old Testament, a lot is not. And questions of historicity, there is, for example, a complete book of Isaiah, including the chapter, which is, I think, 39 or 38, where the sun goes backwards 15 degrees. I don't believe that's a literal historical event, although it's recorded in the Old Testament, because the earth would have to reverse its rotation for that to happen, go back for an hour and a half and change, and the earth can't really, for many reasons, can't reverse its rotation aside from the fact that all the water would rush towards the poles that is now held at the equator by centrifugal force and a few other things. So the question of historicity of those Dead Sea Scrolls is entirely different from authenticity. I didn't want to get into any discussions as to the historicity of the Book of Mormon here. I'm just trying to look at its authenticity, whether it could have been genuinely old record.
Thank you, Terry.
I'm sure some of you have questions. This session is being recorded, so we'd like to get your question on the tape as well as the answer. So anyone who has a question, please come up here and state it. And if there are more than one of you, you can line up. We've got some empty chairs here. Questions? Yes.
Terry notes several assumptions, I think. The so-called gold plate rubbings, assumed marginal markings, assumed movers or helpers of plates, assumed angelic assistance. And quite frankly, I, up until Mike kind of clarified the whole thesis, I wasn't sure exactly what the thesis was, and how, as stated in the paper, did Joseph Smith use the Bible as a Rosetta Stone to translate the gold plates? I'm not sure that I understood exactly the whole process that that Terry is trying to explain to us. If you could, number one, clarify your thesis to us, and then briefly explain exactly what you mean.
Well, I, one of the problems of putting the thesis down is I do make a sort of assumptions, and I'm trying to work towards some maximizing the intellectual aspects of the translation and minimizing the revelatory aspects, and that's kind of a you know, an inexact thing. But for one thing, the I would have to assume that the golden plates have the different books marked somehow on the golden plates. It's apparent when one chapter of Isaiah stops and another chapter ends, that somehow it's organized in, I know, indented or something, that you see the chapter by chapter. Also, on page 3 of the handout, I do note that there's 13 consecutive chapters of Isaiah, one after another, that appear in the golden plates, in consecutive chapters of 2 Nephi, and there's different numbers of lines that appear in the biblical chapters. I'm just taking my King James version from the and counting up number of lines, like 95 lines for Isaiah 2, 103 for Isaiah 3, and they form a distinctive pattern of length. And so, if you possibly, they're also a distinctive pattern of length of these different chapters on the golden plates that would help you figure out where you were in Isaiah and even in the Old Testament. And I say maybe Joseph Smith also gets, you know, if he needs some help from an angel, he gets some help from an angel. I just don't want the angel to have to whisper the entire thing into his ear. And that's a kind of a subjective feeling of mine. But once you've got a chapter and you word for word, I know, then you can, now grammatically the word order won't be exactly the same, but you look for, you try to look for repeated words. You know, certain words, common words are going to be repeated over and over, other words that show up, there's a whole science to translation, and how I don't want to get into how Champollion and others did it on the Rosetta Stone, but they had to. It took time to work it out, and that would take us. I'm not a professional linguist, so I don't know the details. I do know that the Rosetta Stone was used to do it, and I don't know all the details of that. So
that's a good question.
Other questions?
I'm uncomfortable with the assumption that Joseph Smith was a dictaphone reading something off of a screen, and always have been. And I like the presenter's hypothesis that what we're dealing with in the Isaiah passages is in some way a means for Joseph Smith to learn Reformed Egyptian, rather than Joseph Smith's pathetic attempt to try and make the Book of Mormon sound like the Bible. So I like the idea that we preserve an element of Joseph Smith's personality and learning and background and education here. And I would like a response to the question I'm trying to formulate from both of these people. One thing that we tend to rely on heavily is the idea that Joseph Smith was working with a text, and that he was reading something as he translated. But I wonder if we don't forget that Joseph Smith showed a remarkable ability throughout his life to remember spoken language. And I'm wondering if what we're not encountering is a combination of Joseph Smith's having spent for a period of 4 years a very intense tutoring with Moroni, and in that same period having spent time trying to understand what Moroni was telling him and using the Bible as a guide. I think, and the thing I like about this hypothesis is that Joseph Smith could go to the Bible at any time, but even if he's restricted during that time period to only the time when Moroni is talking to him, his memory is working to help him understand what he's learning from Moroni and what he's possibly, therefore, learning about Reformed Egyptian. Moroni talks, and all throughout the Book of Mormon, the way in which the text, the ability to read and write this strange amalgam of a language is transmitted is by father tutoring son. And in this case, I wonder if there wasn't a very intense period of tutoring by Moroni of Joseph Smith. The last thing I would say is, I've always been troubled by the idea that Joseph was reading something. And as far as I can tell, the stories of Joseph putting a stone in a hat and then sticking his face in the hat band and reading it originate with Emma rather than anyone else. And it sounds to me more like a frontier tall tale than it does like an accurate description. Joseph was unwilling to describe how he translated, except to say translated by the gift and power of God. And I would like to believe that there was more of this gift and this power involved in Joseph's personality than in his ability to see a text on what we might describe as a PDA, a pre-electronic PDA, but nonetheless just something that he's reading. I would like to believe that he's reading a text and translating it on the fly. Now, I wonder if I can get a response to that.
Well, quickly, there's interesting comments there. How much time did Joseph Smith have, you know, aside from his farm duties as a farm boy, to spend with Moroni for tutoring?
One night every year, 4 years.
That's not very much time.
It's not much time. I'm asking, yeah, does Joseph have eidetic memory? Can he remember what he's seen?
Yeah.
We don't need to ponder rather than a text for Joseph to remember the things he's seen on the
Okay. That I don't know. I have heard of people who have this eidetic memory and this total recall of things they've seen virtually. And I don't know if Joseph Smith showed evidence of that.
Mike, did you have something to add?
Just one comment on his memory. There was an article not too long ago, and I think it was BYU Studies, where they looked at Joseph Smith translation, and there was a period there where Joseph had taken a break and had come back, and he retranslated portions that he forgot he had already done, and there were differences. So if he had this photographic memory, it seems that it would have been exact the same. My, as a believer in the Book of Mormon, I believe that his personality is still noticeable in the Book of Mormon, that he used the language of his time and ideas that he was comfortable with.
Thank you to both Terry and Mike. This concludes the session. I want to thank you all for coming. The tape of this session is on sale, will be on sale shortly, so if you're interested in buying that, you can get that at the front desk. Thank you.
Thank you for making this an interesting conversation.